At lunchtime, I was reminded that I had not said anything concerning the Reformed tradition and the enjoyment of a good meal. Now, I will try to remedy that by way of preface. This is an important part of our Reformed tradition and a element in the tradition which corrects a popular misunderstanding of Calvin and our Presbyterian heritage. Calvin is sometimes pictured as a person who had no sense of beauty, no awareness of the common pleasures of life. But this is essentially an unfair picture. And Calvin tells us that one part of the Christian life is the enjoyment of God's creation. Calvin says that God could have made clothing so that it would keep the body warm and serve the purposes of modesty. But God made such a world that we can have clothing which adds to the appearance of a man. In other words, the enjoyment of beautiful clothing and what beautiful clothing does to human appearance is part of the Christian life. He also said that God could have provided us with food which would satisfy the demands of our bodies, of which not would not taste very good. But in addition to satisfying the nutritional needs, God gave us food which tastes very good indeed. And then Calvin said that God could have given us water and nothing else to drink, but in his goodness he also gave us wine. Total abstinence did not become part of the Christian ethic except for special groups such as the monastics until the improvement in methods of distillation and the rise of an industrial civilization caused the Christian community to rethink the meaning of love for neighbor and respect for human personality. And the point here is that the enjoyment of creation is part of the Christian life. One of the most persistent ideas in the whole history of ideas is that the created world is evil. The world of flesh and blood is evil, and that salvation is somehow escaped from this world of flesh and blood. But one of our fundamental Christian ideas, and one of the most important ideas in our Calvinistic tradition, is that the world is good. Essentially good, because God made it. And if we do not enjoy this world that God made, there is something wanting in our Christian life. Or I suppose you could put it this way. A man who does not enjoy eating a good dinner either has a bad theology or a bad stomach. And while I'm mentioning these matters by way of preface and parenthesis, as it were, let me say something which I omitted saying this morning in connection with the Calvinist liturgy. I mentioned the fact that the liturgical heritage in our tradition emphasizes intelligibility. We ought to know what we're doing and why we're doing it in worship. Another aspect of this is the significance and the importance of an informed congregation. It is impossible to make use of our Calvinist heritage and liturgy today unless the congregation is informed and capable of participating in this heritage and in this liturgy. The question, therefore, is not simply what quality of sermon can the minister preach, but also what quality of sermon can the congregation appreciate. Now, one of the most serious indictments of what we have done with our Calvinist heritage is the very low order of sermon appreciation what I suppose you might call sermon taste in our congregation. We have many congregations which simply could not appreciate a good sermon in the Calvinistic tradition. Now, this is not altogether the fault of the congregation. In part, it's the fault of the minister. And not infrequently, we ministers allow the congregation to set the level for the quality of our sermons. I suppose one of the best indexes as to what a minister has done in a pastorate is the difference between the sermon taste of the congregation, or the capacity of the congregation to appreciate preaching when he began his ministry, and the capacity of a congregation to appreciate preaching when he ends his ministry. In other words, if we are to be a truly Calvinist church today, reviving our Calvinist heritage in liturgy, in theology, and so forth, it is not enough that we have good ministers. We also must have good congregations. A congregation makes a minister. I do not suppose it's possible to be a great minister without having a great congregation. Because a mediocre congregation, and here I do not mean a congregation numbered, measured, greatness measured simply in terms of members or simply in terms of budget, but an awareness of and appreciation of Christian faith, that you cannot have a great preacher unless you complement him with a great congregation. This is one of the fundamental ideas that comes to us out of a new appreciation of our Calvinist heritage and tradition. Now, let us move on. I mentioned this morning two characteristics which distinguish us as Presbyterians and set us apart, as it were, from other Christians. One of these was our intellectualism, our emphasis upon the life of the mind at the service of God. And then I had mentioned and had begun to discuss our emphasis upon the law, upon obedience to the will of God. Martin Luther, as I said, emphasized forgiveness. The Christian life is the experience of the grace of God. But when Calvin came on the scene, the critics of the Reformation were saying that Protestantism could not produce the Christian man or the Christian society. Now, Calvin himself was very sensitive to this criticism. And one of his great achievements was the establishment in Geneva of the Christian society and the edification of the Christian man. Whatever else a Presbyterian is historically, he is an ethical man. Now, it seems to me that in our time, we are seriously in danger of losing this tradition of obedience to the will of God, this emphasis upon the commandments of God as an essential part of the Christian life. There was a time when a Presbyterian was distinguishable by the quality of his life. Now, I am not sure that our neighbors recognize us because we are moral men. Unfortunately, the word moral has become almost an ugly word in contemporary theology. And when you mention morality, someone always says, well, this is Puritanism raising its ugly head. This is legalism. Well, of course, we as Presbyterians have always run the danger of legalism. For Calvin, this was a calculated risk. Calvin would rather run the danger of dropping off into legalism than the danger of immorality. Now, you have to pay your money and take your choice. You have to run one risk or the other. And our Presbyterian forefathers always said It is better to run the risk of being a legalist, a moralist, than it is to run the risk of immorality, looseness of life. So historically, we have been distinguished as folks who have said that obedience to the will of God is a fundamental aspect of the Christian life. And thus the Puritans found themselves at home with Calvinist theology. And part of our heritage as American Presbyterians stems from the English Puritan as well as from the Scottish Presbyterian. Let us move further now to another characteristic of this heritage which we brought to this country from Britain and from the continent of Europe. We may call it an emphasis upon the sovereignty of God. Or if you like, you may call it a dynamic conception of history. Calvinists and Presbyterians have always been distinguished by their emphasis upon God's sovereignty. And I suppose this is best known in terms of the doctrine of predestination. But John Calvin did not relegate God's sovereignty simply to the ultimate destinies of heaven and of hell. Rather, he believed that human history is the arena in which God's sovereignty is continually making itself visible. In other words, here and now, in this time and in this place, God's eternal purposes are being worked out. And more than this, the sovereign God, who is the master of history, has elected me to be the instrument for the working out of the divine purpose here and now. John Calvin was convinced that God had elected him to do God's work in Geneva. This is the conviction which gave such tremendous power to the early Calvinists. This is the conviction which made them revolutionists, converters of society. They were men who were on the move, in conquest of the world, the flesh, and the devil. When Calvin comes to describe the Christian life, he does not describe it simply in terms of saying your prayers and going to church on Sunday morning and refraining from profanity. Rather, he says that the Christian life is a conquest, an engagement with the world. The Christian is a man who is on the move. He is part of the Lord's army, out to do in the Lord's enemies. He is in conquest of history, in conquest of society. Therefore, the man who simply retires from the world cannot be a Christian in the Reformed tradition. One of the most serious things which has happened in the life of our church is, it seems to me, in relation to our heritage, is the development of a pietistic conception of a Christian. Now, pietism is always one of the alternating movements in the Christian church, in which the Christian, as it were, as it withdraws from the world and defines the Christian life in terms of personal morality, saying his prayers, refraining from profanity, and going to church. I strongly suspect that Calvin would have a man who did not measure too well in some of these aspects, but who was engaged in the battle with evil in human history, in his church. In any case, one classic definition of a Calvinist is the man who has been convicted that God has called him to do the divine work, that God has called him to be the instrument of the divine purpose here and now. in time and space, in human history. And thus the Calvinists are the great converters of society. In the Christian tradition, you have had Christian folk who have wanted to retire from society, or who wanted to simply build upon society, but the Calvinists have always been people who wanted to convert society, conquer society in the name of the Lord. The most frequent metaphor which Calvin uses for the Christian life is taken from the military. The Christian is God's soldier. And more than this, the Christian is God's hero. The Calvinist ethic is a heroic ethic, where the Christian stands on the battlement, alone, if need be, against all the forces of darkness, and waits for the dawn to come in the calm assurance that the divine purposes will be fulfilled. Colonel Francis Miller tells a very interesting story, which I think illustrates this Calvinist confidence about history. He says that immediately after the Second World War, when he was on the intelligence staff of the American forces in Germany, an officer in his group met with a young communist, and the young communist said to the American, "Have you read Karl Marx?" And the American replied that he had. Then the communist said, "Then you know how this is going to come out." But it would have been a wonderful thing if this American officer had been a Calvinist in the great tradition, who could have said, "Have you read the New Testament? Then you know how this is going to come out." When Khrushchev says, "We will bury you," he is giving expression to his confidence that he knows how history is going to come out. Well, as Calvinists, we believe that we know how history is going to come out. It's somewhat like being in a football game in the first quarter and having seen the final scoreboard. You don't know who's going to make the touchdowns. You don't know how the game is going to be played up and down the field, but you know what the final score is. And so it is with the Calvinist hero, who stands on the battlement, alone, if need be, against all the forces of darkness, watching for the light to come, because he is convinced that the sovereign Lord of history shall hold the end of history in his hand. And that more than this, he already knows what this end shall be, because the end has been made known in Jesus Christ. Now, this tremendous conviction that God is working in history, and that the Calvinist has been called to be the instrument of God's purpose, means that the Calvinists were frequently revolutionist. They did not object to upsetting the status quo because they believed that God had greater and better things in store for the world. This is probably one of the reasons that the middle class folk became Calvinists. It is an interesting thing that Lutheranism was first on the ground in Holland, but Holland became a Calvinist country. It is also an interesting fact that Lutheranism was first on the ground in Scotland, but Scotland became a Calvinist country. How is it that you explain this? Well, unquestionably, there were many factors. But some have said that there was an affinity between the rising merchant classes, the rising middle class, and this dynamic Calvinist understanding of history. The Calvinists were ready to change things. They were ready to engage the world. And this laid hold of the imagination of the new merchants, the rising business class and middle class. Certainly this is only part of the picture, but it's a rather significant fact that all through our tradition, from Switzerland on, we have been dominantly a middle-class church. Now, more than any other church in America, the Presbyterian Church is a middle-class denomination. Protestantism as a whole represents the population as a whole. But a higher percentage of our membership belongs to the middle class, and does the membership of any other denomination. According to some studies, a higher percentage of our membership belongs to professional groups than any other denomination. We have almost as many businessmen as the Episcopalians and the Jews. We do not have people either in the same numbers in the working groups as certain other churches, the Baptists or the Roman Catholics, nor do we have the upper class and say quite the same percentage that the Episcopalians do. We are dominantly a middle class church. And it raises a very interesting question. What is the source of this affinity between our Presbyterian heritage and middle class folk? Now, this can be debated and elaborated far longer than I have time to here, but it is a significant fact. Now, this dynamic conception of history led also to a conception of society. Calvin was concerned about a Christian society. He was not concerned simply that Geneva should have individuals who were Christian. He was concerned that Geneva should be Christian. Now, one of the great achievements of Calvin in Geneva was the transformation of that city's life. Geneva had a reputation for being a city of immorality and of crudeness. But after Calvin, it had a reputation for piety. John Knox, who was not an entirely unbiased observer, once said that Geneva was the most perfect school of Christ on earth since the days of the apostles. Another refugee to Geneva said that here was something that had never happened anywhere else on the face of the earth. Men and women from various countries, many different kinds of life and society, were here united in a common community, which shared in a common faith and hope and life and commitment. In any case, Geneva was transformed, so it now has a reputation for piety and for learning. Calvin transformed the bars, for example. He didn't eliminate the bars, but he transformed them. He insisted that in the bars in Geneva there always must be an open Bible, publicly displayed to remind the folk who came there that they had pledged themselves to be reformed according to the Word of God. And secondly, he insisted that the barkeepers stimulate and instigate edifying conversation among their customers. And thirdly, the bars had to close at 9 o'clock. Calvin had help in the development of a city known for its piety. Refugees had come to Geneva for conscience sake. Here were folk who knew in literal trope what it is to let goods and kindred go and to risk this mortal life also for the sake of the gospel. And more than this, the city council made it imperative that you at least agree publicly with this reformation of life. They did not say that you had to agree to it, but they said you had to agree to it if you were going to live in Geneva. So you had the option of being reformed by the Word of God or moving on. You could banish from Geneva the recalcitrant, unrepentant souls. But when the Calvinist descendants came to Scotland, they carried with them this vision of the Christian community. And as Calvin had done in Geneva, so they did in Scotland. A nation with a reputation for uncouthness, for roughness of manner, now acquired a reputation for piety and for learning around this planet. And the spiritual descendants in England sought to establish in England's green and pleasant land the New Jerusalem. They tried to do it in part through the state, but then during the Puritan Revolution, when it became clear that no one group dominated the society, And more than this, there became the awareness that because of the limitations of man's mind and because of man's sinfulness, no government and no man is wise enough to pick out a religion for another man. There came the awareness that the New Jerusalem must be established not through the power of the state, but through the power of the preached word and the testimony of the Christian community's life in the larger community. Now here, on theological grounds, the Puritans adopted a doctrine of denominations. John Calvin could never have conceived a community with a multiple of Christian churches. The Puritans adopted it for the reasons I've indicated. But they did not give up this vision of the Christian community. They rather said that they would run the risk of influencing the total community simply through the power of the preached word and the testimony of the Christian community's life. This is the reason the Puritans became great preachers. And this is the reason in our Westminster Presbyterial Directory for Worship and Order of Presbyterial Government, so much attention is given to homiletics. Those of you who have read the Westminster Directory of Worship know that you almost have here a miniature textbook in homiletics. They did this because they believed so much depended upon the power of the preacher to affect a change in society and in the people who listen to him. And therefore the Puritans were great preachers because they believed so much depended on preaching. For example, in many of the Anglican Church of England churches, you had the vicar who received the stipend from the endowments. And then you had a reader or a preacher who happened to be a Puritan who was invited in to preach. But his salary was paid from the free will offering. So if he didn't produce as a preacher, he didn't get paid. But there was something more here than simply getting paid. There was the early Puritan vision of a Christian England. And the way they were going to get this Christian England was by preaching it in and by the influence of the Christian community's life on the larger community. And therefore they became great preachers. Now then at a later time they became disillusioned. The Holy Community did not fully come off. And you have Puritans retiring, as it were, into a kind of private pietism. In the early days of Puritanism, they saw this as part of a cosmic drama, something God was doing in human history. And then, when the Calvinist forefathers came to New England, they carried with them this vision of the Christian community. The people who settled Massachusetts were not simply seeking freedom to say their prayers and to go to church on Sunday morning as they pleased. They were seeking freedom to establish on this earth the Christian commonwealth, the holy community. They had a gimmick in their arrangement of society. You did not have to be a Christian. You did not have to be devoted to this idea of the Holy Commonwealth to live in Massachusetts. You could live there as an inhabitant. But you couldn't be a citizen unless you shared this vision, unless you were a member of the church. This was a prerequisite for voting. And this worked very well until some of the children of the saints did not want to be saints, but they wanted to vote. And so it broke down. But something of this vision has lingered with us in our vision of this nation as a Christian nation. And here we cannot effect it through political action. We can only effect this by the way, the risky way which our forefathers deliberately chose, the power of the preached word to create a godly public opinion. And the testimony of the Christian community's life in the larger community in such a way that the larger community is changed. It is worthwhile recalling at this particular moment that the only power that John Calvin ever had in Geneva was the power of a tremendous personality and the power of a preacher of the Word of God, a preacher who could elicit a godly public opinion. As a matter of fact, Calvin was not even a citizen of Geneva until 4 or 5 years before his death. In our Presbyterian tradition, we have had the vision, not simply of the individual Christian, but of the Christian community. And we have believed that this Christian community could be brought into being through the power of the preached word and through the testimony of the Christian community's life. This is a tremendous dynamic understanding of history. The history of men and women who believed that they had been called, elected by the sovereign God to do the sovereign God's work in a particular time and in a particular place. And this is the reason that Presbyterians have sometimes been revolutionists. Actually, Presbyterians have been both revolutionists and conservatives. And I suppose it was proper a few years ago, and we had the chance of voting for a Presbyterian under the banner of the Republican Party and voting for a Presbyterian under the banner of the Democratic Party. We have had both the revolutionist and the conservative. The revolutionist who believes, who sees that God is breaking up old patterns of life and establishing new ones, and the conservative who sees God's will in the pattern of life which has been established. And Calvinists from the very beginning have been torn between these tensions. And I suppose we'll have to live with this tension. The conservative principle of our religion and the radical principle of our religion, and we shall have to hold them in tension. But we're united in our conviction that the sovereign God is the Lord of history, and that he is working in this history of 1961, and that he has called us to do his work in this particular area that's covered by Nashville Presbyterian, and in this particular nation in which we are part, and in this particular world in which we are world citizens. These three basic convictions, it seemed to me, shape the classic Presbyterian Reformed personality and embody themselves in a society where Presbyterians are influential. This emphasis upon the life of the mind is the service of God. This emphasis upon obedience to the law as the will of God. This awareness that the sovereign God is active in history and that he has elected his people to carry out his work, not in some far off heaven or hell, but here and now in time and space. And now let us pass to America. These Calvinist Puritan forefathers of ours came to America bringing with them their heritage from Geneva and from Edinburgh. Some of them settled in New England with the Puritans. Some of them settled in Virginia with the early settlers there in the Church of England. How can you designate a Presbyterian or a Calvinist in England in 1607? There were many pure Presbyterians within the church. Certainly Virginia was settled by low churchmen in the Church of England. And they came in the 17th century to Charleston, French Huguenots, English Puritans, and a few Scottish pioneers. And then they came in the great waves of immigration from Northern Ireland and from Scotland, settling in Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley, in western Pennsylvania, in the Piedmont region of the Carolinas, and then moving on westward. They carried with them these great Calvinistic ideas. Now, we do not have time to discuss the history of Presbyterianism in America in detail, but I would like to emphasize several crises. And the first is the crisis between the old side Presbyterians and the new side Presbyterians, which occurred in 1741 with a split in the colonial Presbyterian church, and which was reunited, at least organizationally, in 1758. This controversy in 18th century Presbyterianism was essentially a controversy between Presbyterians who wanted to duplicate in America a European Scottish church, and Presbyterians who believed that in meeting a new situation on the frontier, the Calvinist heritage must be expressed in new and living ways. The old side wanted to place a Scottish minister in a Scottish church on the frontier. But a Scottish minister with the mores, the ethos, the manner of life of a Scottish minister was simply irrelevant on the American frontier. The new side, who shared in the Scottish heritage, and also who shared largely in English Puritan heritage, wanted to creatively relate the life of the church, the heritage and the tradition, to the frontier situation of American Presbyterianism. And this ended up with the churches dividing. And you have the old side and the new side. And they stayed divided for almost 20 years. And during the time of this division, the old side did not grow at all. As a matter of fact, it lost in strength. But the new side grew many times over. It was with the new side Presbyterians, with those who were willing to meet a new situation in a creative and dynamic way, that the tradition lived and was preserved in American Presbyterianism. Now you can elaborate this on down to the present time. And I think from the beginning you have something of this tension between those in the Presbyterian church who have wanted to reproduce an old church from another time and another place in a new situation, and those who wanted to relive the heritage and the tradition in a creative way, in a new time, and in a new place. Now some, particularly Professor Trenerode of McCormick Seminary, have identified the old side with Scottish Presbyterianism and the new side with Puritanism. It seems to me this is far too simple that the new side can be identified with Scottish Presbyterianism also. But we have had this basic and fundamental conflict between the old side and the new side in American Presbyterianism from the beginning of the 18th century to the present day. And now let us move still a step further. As has already been indicated in the Presbytery meeting today, our existence as a particular denomination came into being amid the slavery crisis and the Civil War of the 19th century. To put it in theological language, as a denomination, We were conceived in sin, and in iniquity did we come into existence. And it seems to me that we have to face this fact honestly and clearly. And certainly some of the greatest embarrassment in our heritage is the attempt of some of our finest forefathers to justify slavery as a divine institution. Benjamin Morgan Palmer, one of the great preachers of our tradition, in his famous Thanksgiving sermon declared that slavery was a divine ordinance and it was the great providence of God that the Southern Presbyterian Church was to maintain this institution for the well-being of human society. This is one of the dismal blots when the pressures of the world seem to coerce the preaching of the Word of God. And yet, our existence as a denomination is part of the providence of God. And so we have to ask ourselves, what in God's providence is being said to us in the fact that we did come into existence amid the crisis of the 19th century? And what is our significance as a regional church? This, I think, is a question which we have to face honestly and vigorously today as we recall our existence as a separate denomination from 1861. Admittedly, the South is not one region. It is a multiple of regions. There are a number of regions in the area encompassed within our church. And yet, when we speak of the South, we know exactly what we mean. And when we speak of the area in which our church exists, this is at least a loosely definable area. So in this sense, let us say that we are a regional church. And let us put the question to ourselves very directly. Can we be at the same time a regional church and a Christian church? We have a right to be a regional church only as we face this question, if we have a right to be a regional church at all. Of course, if we were a national church, we would simply face the question in a larger context. But let us face it now in the context of being a regional church within a nation. From the very beginning, the Christian community has said that one of the marks by which you know the church is its Catholicity. The Church of God is a Catholic church. They went on to say that it is one Catholic church. To say the church is one and to say the church is Catholic is virtually to say the same thing. There is not one church for the British and one church for the French, one church for the Chinese and one church for the Africans, one church for the whites and one church for the reds. There is simply the Church of Jesus Christ, which has within it the remedy for the sins of all men. From the beginning, we have said that the Church is Catholic, and our forefathers said in our Protestant tradition that they were Catholic churches. We confess our faith in the Holy Catholic Church. Well, can we be a manifestation of the universal Catholic Church and at the same time a regional church? Now, as we seek to answer this question, I think we have to say honestly and fearlessly that there are serious risks in a regional church. There is a serious risk that our vision shall not be Catholic, but provincial. That our understanding of the gospel shall not be deep and broad, but shallow and narrow. We have to admit And as a regional church, we run the danger of isolating ourselves from other Christians around this world, of trying to retire from the history which engulfs this entire planet. As a matter of fact, this is what we did do. To the shame and discredit of our church. In the early 1800s, Southern Presbyterians were Catholic in their outlook. There was frequent contact, for example, between Columbia Theological Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, and theological institutions in New England. But if someone had proposed calling a man from Andover Newton in New England to a professorial chair at Columbia Theological Seminary in 1930, he would have been immediately fired for heresy. This is what happened to our church in the first half of the 20th century. If you go to the Columbia Theological Seminary Library, you will find that in the 1800s, they bought books that were published in Germany, in Europe. But if you review the purchases from, say, 1890 to 1940, you will find very few books. And what was true here at Columbia was true of all of our seminaries. It's a rather striking thing that in 1940, not a single Southern Presbyterian institution, theological seminary or college, possessed a complete edition of Calvin's works. We could borrow them from the Methodists at Duke, but as Presbyterians, we didn't have them. If you will go to any of our theological seminary libraries, you will discover that we did not buy any books that were published outside our own little circle in this period from, say, around 1885 until 1940. We became, in real truth, a provincial church. This can be illustrated not only with our seminary libraries, but with our seminary faculty. In the early 1800s, we had seminary faculties who were educated outside the boundaries of our church. But from 1890 to 1940, very few of our seminary professors had any graduate education at all, much less outside the boundaries of our church. In 1860, South Carolina possessed an intellectual leadership which was in theology and in polity, which was unsurpassed in America. As a matter of fact, one reason for holding the Augusta Assembly in Augusta was because it would be near to this tremendous intellectual ferment that was going on in South Carolina at that time, though it had already begun to die on the vine, as it were, to become a provincial. But since that day, South Carolina, the Senate of South Carolina, has not possessed theological competence to command the respect even of our total denomination, much less theological world of which we are part. Why did this happen to us? It happened to us because we shut ourselves up and said we were going to live our own life, and we didn't really care what happened in the rest of the world. It was a tragic thing. I can give you another illustration. Immediately before the Civil War, Columbia Theological Seminary instituted a chair on theology and natural science. Charles Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859. Columbia Seminary was willing to establish a chair of theology to deal with this new science. And they elected to that first professorship James Woodrow. Now, James Woodrow was the uncle of Woodrow Wilson. He may have been the first Southern Presbyterian to receive a PhD degree, which he did from Heidelberg. He was a learned man, and he became professor at Columbia Seminary, but in 1880 he was fired for heresy and became president of the University of South Carolina. From that day on, our church lived a very narrow, shallow, provincial life. And the consequences of this provincialism, which dominated in an incredible way the entire life of our church from the last decades of the 19th century until at least 1940, the scars of this provincialism are still with us. So it seems to me we have to admit boldly and candidly that a regional church has its perils, but on the other hand, it also has its possibilities. As a regional church, which is aware that it is a regional church, and therefore is alert to the dangers of provincialism, alert to the dangers of denying true Catholicity, can be a Catholic church in this region in the way in which a national church or an international church could not be an indigenous church relating the gospel in a Catholic way in our own particular situation. I would be willing to argue that there is some case that this is already apparent. Take the matter of race relations, which is an emotionally sensitive subject and a very difficult one. I think the case could be argued that the Southern Presbyterian Church has a better record for maintaining the integrity of the church as the church amid these racial tensions than any other church in America, with the sole exception of our denominational colleges. There's no way to justify our denominational colleges as Catholic colleges, and it raises in question their claim to be church colleges. Here, incidentally, I'll throw in something, by the way, for which you are not paying me, which I give you gratis. You can take it for what it's worth. I was reared in church colleges, and I lived all my life there, and I came up thinking that the Christians went to the church schools and the pagans went to the state schools. And then I had 11 years of my ministry on the campus of one of the largest state schools in the South. And I had to revise my opinion. I used to go to Montreat for the Presbyterian Educational Association and hear our Presbyterian educators talk about the Christian institutions and the secular institutions. What they really meant, the denominational institutions and the state institutions. And it's not so simple to call them the Christian and the secular. Because the Christian community exists more or less on the state campus, and it exists more or less on the church school campus. And sometimes the Christian community is more visible on the state campus than it is on the church school campus. There was a time when the church school had to exist because no one else was educating people, but that time is now gone. The state schools have better resources in faculty and laboratories and books in students than we do in church schools. And it's become increasingly a passionate conviction of mine that there is only one justification for a church school, and that is for boys and girls to be given the opportunity to engage in the academic enterprise under the discipline of the morality and the worship and the faith of the Christian community. And that apart from this, there is no justification for a church school. in our time, and if a boy or girl does not want to engage in the academic enterprise under this discipline, I think he should go not to a church school, but to a state institution. But that's by the way. What I'm saying is that apart from our church schools, we have met the crisis, I think, in our church of maintaining the integrity of the body of Christ amid racial tensions, better than any other denomination in America. So a case can be made that as a regional church, we can be here a Catholic church in a deep way, that a church which is non-regional in organization cannot be. And yet if we give this answer, we have to give it with fear and trembling, lest our regionalism should make us blind to regionalism of the spirit, and to regionalism of faith, and to regionalism of ethics. For as the Church of Jesus Christ, we must be the Holy Catholic Church. Well, I've spoken in my time. Let me say this in conclusion. It seems to me that as Presbyterians, we are called by God to represent the very best in our Presbyterian, Puritan, Protestant tradition in our communities. This is the only justification I know for denominations, or at least the best justification. We are called to bring the riches of our tradition to the total life of the Christian community, of which we are but one manifestation. Our task is to be Presbyterians, Calvinists, in the best of our tradition. And when we do this, we make our greatest contribution to the total life of the Christian community, of which we are but one part. Professor Dr. John Mackay once said that he had never felt so much Presbyterian, and he had never felt so little Presbyterian as now. And both statements are true. For many of us today, we have never been so little Presbyterian, because we are so aware of what we call in our time the ecumenical movement, the total body of God's people. We've never been so aware that we are not the entirety of the church, but one manifestation of the body of Christ. But on the other hand, we have never been so Presbyterian as we are now, because we are proud indeed of the heritage which is ours. And we believe that this heritage has much to commend to those who live in our time. We lost the frontier in America in part because we said that we would not lower the educational requirements of the ministry. When Presbyterians in Kentucky petitioned the Synod in Philadelphia to lower the requirements of the ministry, of the Synod in Philadelphia in the 1780s, on several occasions replied by raising the requirements. We said it is more important to maintain a competent ministry than it is to win the frontier. We said it was more important to maintain the integrity of our theology than to win the frontier. This may have been a mistake. But the very thing which cost us the frontier may, in our time, give us an opportunity of making our greatest ministry and rendering our greatest testimony in the history of God's holy, Catholic, and apostolic people. Amen.